Welcome to Failing Up. We don't have a theme song.
Well, we might not have a theme song, Eden, but we do have a theme, and that is failure.
And we talk to people about their failures and mistakes and how they grew from it.
Simple as that. Listen up.
Thank you for coming to Failing Up. I know I say coming all the time.
Twice now.
And I know.
Do you want to start again?
No, I'm actually going to hold up. This is fine to come to a phone or a podcast. You had to make the effort to come to this occasion. You had to go in your phone or your computer and click some sort of link. So you came.
Thank
all
you.
All right. And please take your head out of the gutter. All right. So thank you. I'm sorry. This is the weirdest introduction. Probably the longest we have on record.
All right. Hi, Guy, my co-host, Guy.
I'm speechless. You seem very upset about this.
Not upset.
You're up in arms, in a sense. No?
No.
Am I crazy?
No.
Maybe our guests will agree with
okay,
us.
Okay, you introduced the guests because I did it last week.
Okay, welcome to Failing Up, writer, producer, Ben Blacker.
Thank you, Ben.
Ooh, you hear
thank
that?
You for having me.
The applause and everything.
Hey,
Ben's
thanks for
very
coming,
excited.
Everyone.
Thank yeah. you. Thank you for
all right,
being.
That's
thanks
it,
for
that's
showing
our show.
Up.
Yes. Good night.
So, I mean, we should get the uncomfortableness out of the way in that we did previously have your writing partner, Ben Acker.
It's the only reason I'm here.
Last season.
Yeah, last season on the show. So there's no, like, you know, I don't know if it's like he came here already. It's not so much fun for me now.
No.
You're number two. It's not that you're number two. I just want to make that clear.
No, in fact, I'm only here because he's done it all.
Oh, really?
That
oh,
I listened weird. To him and saw how you treated him.
Mm-hmm.
You were very,
I mean,
you were very kind.
I kept him hostage in my dungeon for a few hours so we can get the real, like, truth out
yeah.
of him.
Yeah. No, that's what we're into.
But, yeah.
And here's the bad part.
Plus, all the groundwork is laid. So I would urge the listeners to go back and listen to that so I don't have to recap that shit.
That's
oh,
true.
All my questions are the exact same ones. I just copied the Ben Acker ones and moved. I'm kidding.
Won't have
obviously.
It. Won't have it.
So thank you so much for being here. But we do like to start the show in a similar fashion in that a young Ben Black. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Boston.
Oh, okay.
That's the White Sox. That's why I like the White Sox.
But okay. Yeah, you know, but I'm from New Jersey and I like the Yankees. And so people just assume you could be from an area. You could even be from Connecticut.
Yeah, I'm from LA and I love baguette. And that's clearly not from LA. That's from France.
It's pretty much the same thing as being a Yankee or a Red Sox fan. Yeah,
exactly.
So you grew up in Boston.
True.
What did a young Ben want to be? What was he like? What was he into?
Kind of all the same stuff I'm into now.
Really?
And want to be the same thing I want to be now, which is paid as a writer. I think I have known I've wanted to do this job since I was in second grade.
Wow.
Like, there's not much else I'm good at. And I'm not even that good a writer, so... You can
you
imagine
sound
how bad
exactly
everything else
how
is.
How I feel about myself.
Yeah, we're all the same.
Where I was like, I don't know. I literally was sitting in my therapist's office and being like, I don't think I'm good at anything. Like, I can put a sentence together, maybe.
You're one up on a lot of people.
Maybe. I'm not even sure. So you were even not even sure as a kid?
No, I'm new.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
How do you know? That, yeah. See, that's the kind of stuff that fascinates me because I swear until I was like in fourth grade, I think I just wanted to be a magician. And then, yeah.
It's not
stop
too
laughing
late.
At me.
It's
my
not
dream,
late.
Damn it. No, it's not my dream anymore. But no. And then, like, I wouldn't even think. I'm sure I entertain people and all that stuff. I never thought, oh, you could write for a living. Mm-hmm. Like, I just, there have been guests that we have on the show that have been writers that kind of had my side of things where it's like you just consumed it, but you don't realize. Oh, there are people making yes. this and all that stuff. So how do you even realize this?
And
stuff
that was
so
a question I used to ask. I do a podcast called The Writers Panel,
right.
which I talk to writers about the business and process of writing television. And that was a question I used to ask was like, when did you have that lightning bolt moment that this was a thing that was created?
Right.
And honestly, for me, it really was when I was that young. I loved three things. I loved reading, I loved TV, and I loved comic books. And I have an aunt who was a children's librarian. And so she turned me on to a lot of great books at the time and like talked to me about the authors. There were people who wrote these books.
Yeah.
And that is what I thought I would be doing. But I also loved TV so much. And I remember in, I think it was second grade, we had the assignment to write, I think it was a mystery or something. We had read a mystery in school and then we had to write a mystery. And mine ended with, "And that's another case solved by Scarecrow and Mrs. King," which was a popular program at the time. I did fanfic for sure.
That's unbelievable.
Since Netflix seems to be buying everything,
yeah,
like bad stuff too, I think we should get a bunch of kindergartners in a room. Be like, all right, you are staffed writers. The showrunner will be like a real adult.
Right.
You know?
They'll figure out
and
the
then
story.
They'll all pitch ideas like that. And then we'll actually have a show written by 10-year-olds. How is that? A mystery, if you will. Because that's great material. Like, don't you think? I mean, just having like...
No, I think that's...
terrible.
I think that takes us out of the equation. That's no good.
I don't know, because like when I was a kid, I didn't think I could make up stories, but I loved stories. Like I loved mm-hmm. books. I would read the same books. I remembered books so well. My dad told me that I didn't know how to read when I was a kid first. I memorized, but like my parents would read to me mm-hmm. and I memorized the words.
Yes.
And I didn't know how to read, but people were like, holy shit.
But you turned the pages too, right?
Yeah, but like sometimes it was wrong. They're like, oh, she's fibbing. Or like the book was like upside down or some shit. And I'm like, look, I can read. And I can't. I still to this day can't read.
So you were a liar, confession. Which is the first step.
Yeah.
To becoming a professional storyteller.
Or actor. I don't know. Yeah. So yeah, I guess a good liar. Yes. So what made you think that, oh, I can actually get paid?
Oh, I still don't think that.
Oh, okay. Well.
No, I always thought I would write novels. Mm-hmm. I thought I would write, you know, wry observational novels like yeah. Richard Russo.
Sure.
And I think I thought that until 10 years ago. You know, I studied writing and literature at school mm-hmm. with the idea that I would teach. And I did teach high school and middle school for a while.
Oh my gosh, what was that like?
Middle school is great.
Really? It's a good age.
Tell you this.
Really?
It is a good age. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, it surprised a lot of people. But here's the thing. In middle school, they are young enough that they still respect you just because you're taller than they are.
Yeah. And they don't have the ego yet of, no. like, I know everything.
Exactly.
Which is what teenagers exactly. are. Like, I know everything and I'm going to rebel.
Yeah. I taught in Boston and Brookline and I had great 10th grade. Like, I taught honors classes. They were awesome kids.
I loved my honors English class so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't smart enough, but...
I had such a... But that teacher in my honors ninth grade class, like, made me want to write.
That's
like,
great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
So you must have had an influence on them. I wonder.
I hope so.
That's great.
A couple... My first teaching job was right out of college. And I had a student recently friend me on Facebook.
Weird.
And I usually don't... Will not accept those. I haven't gotten that many, but I usually will not accept
those. He must be
those.
One of your comic book fans, though, I feel.
I like, don't know. She. Oh. I had male and female students.
Okay.
Yeah, I treated them equally.
Was she a special one?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
I hope she's listening.
She was just a run-of-the-mill
student. No, I didn't recognize her name until she... And she's married now, but okay. I didn't recognize her name until
what?
She told me.
Doesn't that make you feel old?
It's crazy.
That's yeah. so weird.
She wow. has a child. Possibly two? Yeah.
Weird.
Ridiculous.
Oh, my God. Gross.
So let's back up for one second. Your aunt. I feel like you owe your aunt in a big sense, no? Like,
absolutely.
That's so amazing that she put you... Like, she helped guide you into that position. Obviously, you had to love it, right? You had to like
right.
it. It's not like it wasn't something you cared about, but like she definitely pushed you towards.
Yes, she opened a door to which I was ready to walk through.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, she was the librarian at my elementary school for a long time, for I guess a couple of years while mm-hmm. I was there. They moved around a lot. But yeah, she made it a real thing and, you know, introduced us to lots of different kinds of books and until we found the ones we liked. And then her daughter, who's my oldest cousin, became a writer, a young adult novelist.
Oh, wow.
And so that, when I was like an older teenager, she's probably 10 years older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw her on that path. And like that made it a very real thing. Like her first book sold, you know, for a lot of money and people really responded to it. It made it a thing that was like, oh, you can do this. This is a thing that's possible for even people you know.
Yeah. I was really into Witch Way books when I was young. Do you know what those are?
Someone just brought those up to me. Yeah. Because I'm writing a comic book about witches. And so I've been doing these short interviews asking what someone people's favorite pop culture witches are, and yeah. someone brought that up. So I don't know them. That's a little
which way? After it's not W-I-T-C-H. It's which way? So essentially, you're reading a book, and you get to like a point, and it says the dragon is in the room. If you want the guy to slay the dragon, yeah, same shit.
Oh, that is not what I thought it was.
Okay, you thought it was actually witch.
Yeah, I thought that she called them Which Way Books.
There might be witch.
There may be
Which Way Books.
There's no way to know.
Also, Choose Your Own Adventure. But yes, that's the same. I feel like Choose Your Own Adventure was like the cracked to mad. Which Way and Choose Your Own Adventure? They were two different.
Yeah, Choose Your Own Adventure was the original.
Okay.
You know, the ones, if you did very well, you got those.
You would Choose Your Own Adventure. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong about
No, the garbage people got the Which Way books.
Yeah, you're probably right. It was in our shitty little van that came once a year. I got the Boxcar
Children. Loved the Boxcar Children. Oh my gosh. Those hobo kids. Did
those
you ever
hobo
read
kids.
No.
they were kind of white trash.
Oh, 100%.
You know what I remember reading?
It's a weird series.
Very young, though. It was Judy Blum, and it was Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
I never actually read that.
Well, there's this whole part about her getting her period, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And they use a belt with their sanitary napkins. Like, yep. I specifically remember. It's old school, Eden. And so, yeah, like, that taught me a lot. But yeah, I don't know. For some reason, that's the kind of stuff I read when I was a kid.
I think we all learned a lot from Judy Blume. No joke. I mean, I think a generation of teenagers learned a lot, or preteens learned a lot from those books.
Yeah.
I read all the, like, the B role of Judy Blume. Like, remember Superfudge?
Superfudge. People love Superfudge.
Okay, I don't know why that one was like in my radar more than like fucking Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. It's probably the most like famous one.
I think that one skews younger. She had a bunch of them that were sort of younger books,
like Tiger Eyes and all that.
It was probably just in the bathroom where I grew up. So you know, we didn't
have
phones.
My mom loved Judy Blume. I think more than I did. So here, this woman is just amazing,
and she's a legitimately good writer.
Yeah, she's great.
She's good.
I listened to her masterclass.
Did you?
Because I just wanted to see what she was like, and I have the all access pass to it. So
no big deal.
It's fun to get the all access one. It's pretty cheap. I share it with like five people. It's like a Netflix.
Yeah.
Because I like to see like, you could watch Aaron Sorkin teach screenwriting, but like it's nothing I don't already know. Like he just teaches like, the structure of like a screenplay. Right. But I watch it for the Gordon Ramsay teaches cooking, mm-hmm. for the Serena Williams teaching fucking tennis.
Yeah.
That shit is amazing. Deaf Mouse teaching how to mix like a DJ. It's crazy.
You're watching that, huh? Isn't there a Ron Howard also?
There is.
Yeah.
I will watch that. It's good, but I'm in the middle of R.L. Stein's because his is really fascinating.
That's amazing.
He's so funny.
I would love to watch that.
Did you know how funny he is?
I did not know.
He used to be a comic writer. He used to write for like this like magazine and like it was the humor section of it. And someone like his publisher or something was like, hey, people are asking for like young adult like scary books. Do you want to try one? And it did so well. He's like, well, this is playing better than comedy, so I'll just do this. And he became like a factory machine for it.
That's really funny.
So anyway, but back to
let's get into
after
it.
You taught high school and in middle school. What did you think? Like, I want to go to Hollywood?
No, I was teaching high school, and around that time, I got together with my now wife, and she wanted to go to grad school, and was looking at Anderson at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Acker and I started working together again. We had worked together for a couple of years, and then I moved back to Boston, and so the timing was right. So we moved out here, and he and I started writing together in earnest. It's around them that we started the Thrilling Adventure Hour. I was still teaching high school. I still taught for about 3 years out here. And then sort of, as I'm sure you guys know, and I'm sure you've talked about with other guests, you reach that tipping point where you have to choose one or the other. Yeah,
you can't half-ass.
It's a big leap. But I knew when that time was.
Good. I always feel like... I said this when we had Jay Duplass on. I feel like there needs to be like a mentor, like a boys and girls club, like a mentorship, big brothers, big sisters thing or whatever for people that move out here to be like artists or whatever, like musicians or writers or actors, whatever. And like to like kind of help them when they're struggling mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And they're like, when do I make that leap? And then after they make that leap to transition them into like... working full time in their art. Right. I don't know. I feel like it's needed.
Like you need the time.
You need the guidance for someone to tell you when it's time or when like you got to keep working your 9-to-5
job. Right.
Well, and I think people know, too. I mean, the reason I knew I couldn't teach anymore, and, you know, we were nearing the end of the year, and Ben and I had sold something, a pilot or something, but also it was, like, we had meetings every other day.
Yeah.
And I had to schedule them for after school.
Right.
So, like, if this was going to continue through the next year, it was just untenable.
Yeah. So, were you, like, off the bat writing amazing scripts that you got all these meetings?
Yes, we were brilliant from the beginning. No, I don't
fail. Failing up, so we gotta talk about failures. I'm segueing.
No, I think we had been doing thrilling for a little while, so we were sort of getting our chops by writing a new, 80-page script every month and writing for the actors that for whom we were writing, and we wrote a pilot that people really responded to, and that was. We didn't actually sell it. We got like an IFCOM deal, which is basically someone, a studio attaching, saying that if we sell this, then we'll get behind you on it. And that deal closed the day before the writer's strike.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
2008.
Oh God, I remember that day.
Yeah. So we would like, and Ben may have talked about this on this podcast, but we would like hear from our managers that, hey, this network passed on the pilot. And we're like, what pilot?
Right.
The cut and run, the one that's going out without you getting to pitch it. It's just making the rounds. Like, oh, that's a terrible way to send something out. But it kind of got us a reputation, and people read it, and they liked it, but no one was buying anything.
Wait, back up. Hold on. The Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Yes.
How did that even start?
Really? Didn't he talk about this already?
I don't remember.
Guys, go back and listen.
Seriously. I'm pretty sure you guys were reading
in
your...
I'll give you the nutshell version.
But because that is a successful podcast and show... You know, I'm sure the first time you came out with William Bitt, was it amazing?
Oh, God, no.
See, that's what I wanted to
get
at. Because I don't think we talked.
I don't think you did, actually. And I did listen to that episode. Long time fan of this program. You need to have more people I know on. That's the only way I listen to a podcast.
Yeah. That does help.
That's for everyone in your podcast. Please, just have more people I know.
Okay.
While I was in Boston and Ben was here in Los Angeles, we wrote a feature spec script called Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars, which was a space western. Mm-hmm. And it was a thing we had sort of kicked around for a couple of years. When I moved, honestly, within a week of us moving, my furniture hadn't even arrived yet. We did a little reading of that script with Ben had been working on Paul F. Tompkins' variety show, and he had gone through the Second City program while I was away. So he sort of had, we had Paul and Dave Gruber Allen and sort of some great Second City people, Mark Gagliardi among them. And we did this reading in my living room. And it was, you know who else was there? Vincent Kartheiser from Mad Men. Yeah, it was a weird group.
That's a cool mix.
Hadn't done a ton at the point.
For readings, I think you should always get a cool mix.
It was a fun mix of people who wouldn't otherwise meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we came out saying, like, that script is okay. I think, we learned a lot from it. But mostly that reading was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And there must be a way to do this kind of thing and put it up on its feet and have people watch it and, exploit our talented friends. And so Ben had a friend who sort of helped us find a theater. We started at the M Bar, which does not exist anymore, but was...
I remember the M Bar.
It was a 100-seat supper club. It was a great little space. And they gave us, I think, Thursday nights once a month. And we did the first show, and it was... very difficult.
Yeah.
It was very like we were trying to paint a picture for your mind, and we realized that, and people had fun. Like, we had a good number of people there. It was mostly friends, but we realized coming out of it that people can say they like the show all you want, but it's another thing to hear them laugh. And so we made it a more straightforward comedy the next month, and we made it a little more accessible. We didn't lean so hard on the tropey stuff. We didn't lean so hard on the action.
Right.
It became much more of a character piece. Mm-hmm. And we sort of, over the next 6 months, really put together who would become our core cast for the next 16 years.
Hmm.
We, found our musician in that time. We sort of formalized a lot of the elements of the show.
Yeah.
And we did it for 5 years without recording it at M-Bar, just a monthly stage show. Which we write new every month, and we really learned how to do it in that time.
That's great.
Was there a period there that you were like, oh, it hit? Like you realize, oh my God, I went from, yeah, we have a good amount of people and stuff, and now it's sold out shows.
Yes. There was a point at which, and it wasn't even a sold out show, but there was a point at which we didn't know more people in the audience than we did.
Right.
And that was like, oh, word is getting around. People want to see this. And granted, like having Paul in it and having Padgett Brewster and Mark Evan Jackson was sort of, and Craig Gutkowski were sort of darlings of Second City and IO, certainly helped. So people would come check it out that way. But it really became word of mouth that led to that. And then, you know, we started selling out. Again, it was only a 100-seat club, so it became pretty easy to sell out. And we started doing second shows. And, you know, by the time we moved to Largo, which was 2.5 times the size, we had to move. Because doing two shows or doing in one night or over a weekend or whatever it was just not possible anymore. That was like, if we didn't know already it was time to move, that really helped push us out the door.
And then what is the impetus to then make that into a podcast? I mean, it is a natural fit, right? It's like an old-time radio kind of situation, but yes.
And the idea always was that we would record it, and podcasting wasn't really a thing yet. You know, I think we knew of Jimmy Pardo's show and Doug Loves Movies, and that was kind of it.
And your show.
What was your show?
I had a show called Decently Funny back in... a long time ago. It's fine.
That sounds like you're overselling.
Yes, I am. It was.
He's been podcasting for like 10 years.
Me? Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And we knew like Super Ego started around that time, which was over 10 years ago. But yeah. So it became sort of like this lends itself to the medium. And now that there's an outlet for it, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah.
So yeah, it became a no-brainer just to start recording it.
And it was a unique idea as well. Like, I mean, nobody else was really doing that at the time, were they?
No, we didn't really know of any narrative fiction podcasts at the time. Obviously, a bunch have popped up since then. And we stopped podcasting as soon as people discovered podcasts around 5 years ago.
But I mean, you were making money off it, obviously. You had advertising and all that.
No.
You didn't have any advertising.
No. The stage show, we got enough money to pay the band and the actors. You know, it was self-sustaining.
Right.
But then the podcast, we put it out for ourselves for a couple months just because we wanted to. And we had had the offer to go to Nerdist. And so we went over there and we maybe had ads once in a while, but yeah. All the money went back into the show.
Wow.
For 10 years, which is part of why we had to end it. It's like, we love doing it, but...
this is draining.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of work for 10 years
straight. You should be making money off something like that. Yeah. Decently Funny, we made some okay money.
You did?
Yeah. There were times that you... Yeah.
Must be nice.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. It sucks when like... Well, it sucks when something that's like a good artistic medium... you know, can't monetize.
Well, it was truly a labor of love. People didn't know what to do with it. Like our managers and then our agents would bring executives to the show and they would be like, this is so much fun. And the audience clearly loves it because we were selling out every month at Largo.
Like, what do you do?
And they were like, so what do you like? Do you just put microphones on TV? No, each of these pieces is meant to be spun off into a TV show. Like, there's a space western, there's The Thin Man with Ghosts. These are TV shows, and we have a dozen of them at least.
Right.
So think outside the thing you are actually seeing.
What a common problem with them, yeah. So from that, so you stopped being a Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Yes.
And the writer's strike happened, right?
Well, that was years before.
Yeah. Right. Well, okay.
We were all during Thrilling. We got managers through that. We got agents through that. We got new managers through that.
Yeah.
And eventually new agents through that. But we were selling pilots almost every year.
Wow.
Yeah, and all kinds of things. Like we did an animated pilot presentation for Fox.
Amazing.
We did a half hour for Spike. We did an hour for USA. We did a half hour for USA.
Like, wow.
We did a ton of different things, getting these weird, because nobody understood what we did.
Right.
But people were happy to talk to us and they liked our sample, our pilot sample. And then we got staffed a couple of times and those were good experiences. But mostly, you know, it was just like selling our own stuff. Mm-hmm. And that sort of became... after a certain point, we're like, well, that's going to be the goal.
Right.
You wrote Star Wars fiction. Well, I mean, I guess everything in Star Wars is fiction, right? You wrote for Star Wars.
No, but it's Star Wars autobiography of Chewie. Oh, I know.
Supernatural, right? And the reason I was thinking Supernatural because, and it was one episode, but when you go and write for an episode of Supernatural, there's all this canon, right? That the, the whole, are you a fan of it? Do you have to research it? How, like for one single episode, what, I got to know the deal.
We knew, well, we were on staff for season 7.
Okay.
And we knew that we could write this show because what they did was like, what's your take on an existing monster or myth?
Right.
But this was season 7.
Right.
And so they had done,
they're exhausted,
22 episodes a season, at least.
Wow.
They did have a new, this, I think this was her second year as the showrunner, but who had come up under the original, the creator, who was the original showrunner. And I think two things got us the job. One was we had, in our stage show, we did this part called Beyond Belief, which was a sort of Thin Man plus ghosts. And we would always do exactly that. Like, what's our take on this trope?
Right.
And in the meeting with the showrunner, Acker pitched our take on Peter Pan, which was a creepy goat-legged boy who ate hands. And I think she really dug that.
Yeah.
Because it's a fun idea. It's a good Peter Pan. And then through me doing the writers panel, we met a lot of writers and became friends with them. And David Fury was one of these guys who, you know, he came up on Buffy. He was on 20, I think he ran 24. Mm-hmm. He's been around for years. He wrote some Thrilling Adventure Hour for us. And so he called in and he called into them and said, these guys are really good. You should hire them.
Wow.
So between those two things, we got the job. As far as doing well at the job, that was more difficult because they had done so many episodes. Yeah. So pitching was like, oh, you did that in season 2. Okay.
And their fans are rabid, right? They know like, yes. Oh, no. He could not have said that. In season 2, episode 7, he said...
It's weird. Well, yeah,
that's the thing we didn't have to worry about. Like, there are people who keep that stuff. There were writers who had been there for the entire run who know that stuff. No one was expecting us to do that. And they didn't even expect that we had seen the show.
Right.
Like, we had seen a little of the show, but they gave us all the DVDs and were like, go do your homework, see what we do, get the feel for the show. The writer's assistant at the time, Jenny Klein, was awesome and helped us with a lot of that stuff.
Okay. And do you have to enjoy a show like that to write for it or no?
I think on any show, and we've worked on a couple of shows that we would not necessarily watch ourselves, you find the thing to enjoy, whether it's something in the show. And for us, it was like, what's a take on monsters? That's fun for us.
Right.
Or whether it's the people you're working with, which is what it was on the animated show that we worked on for a couple of years. You know, it was fun to work in that group. I've never laughed so hard as I did with those writers. So I think you find the thing to like. Otherwise, you're going to be miserable the whole time.
And you're also writing, or you've written, I'm sorry, for Join the Resistance?
Join the Resistance. Star Wars, Join the Resistance.
Yeah.
So
every cool thing we've gotten to do, and I'm surprised Ben didn't talk about this when he was on, every cool thing we've gotten to do, like writing Marvel comics and writing Star Wars canon, is because of Thrilling Adventure Hour.
It did pay off.
Yeah. It absolutely has paid off, and it's given us a good reputation, and we came out of it having made great friends and great fans. Among those fans was the editor of the Star Wars books, who knew our show, and they were writing, they were throwing around an idea for like a hotshot space pilot. And the model for this character was Sparks Nevada. And he was like, I wonder who we can get to write those. And he was friends with a friend of ours who was writing another book and was like, why don't you ask those guys? And so he did.
That's pretty amazing.
Marvel was sort of the same way. The editor at Deadpool, that office, he posted a ukulele cover of one of our theme songs.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And I saw it on Twitter and I was like, hi, why aren't we writing for you?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, can you write things that are not funny? I was like, oh boy, can we?
But everything for me feels like all these things are challenges. Another one, like any comic book, but like Deadpool, these people are so rabid and like they, you know.
You can't think of it that way.
You don't even worry about it.
You really can't.
Do you read, like, I went on Amazon. I looked at your reviews. Do you read reviews ever for anything that you write? Like, for the Star Wars Join the Resistance book, 16 Amazon reviews.
That's nice.
14, 5 star.
That's great.
And 2 of them are 1 star.
That's fine, too.
Do you read them?
No.
Okay. The 2 1 star are like the most detailed books.
Why are you even bringing this up?
Are paragraphs because they're clearly adults who wrote them. these are kids' books, right? I mean, yeah, for the most part.
These are books for 10-year-olds.
Yeah, so you can't feel bad when somebody, even if you read it, you'd be like, oh, wait, this is an adult man who's, like, breaking down my book as to why he doesn't like it.
That's why I look, go on Amazon and look at the reviews for, like, water bottles. And, like, it's so much fun. It's the best. Like, I saw a review for water, like, a case of, like, six, like, Fiji waters. Someone wrote, I wasn't thirsty at all. This is a terrible product. I saw a review for, like, a bucket, and they're like, amazing bucket, no holes, held what I needed, you know, great for mopping. Like, it's just so much fun to read reviews for mundane things. It's the best.
I have a thing where it doesn't matter if it's Amazon or Yelp, I go to the 1-star reviews first. Maybe I'm Mr. Negative.
I go to the most recent review, because I feel like that's a good gauge.
Mm-hmm. I'll do that for, like, hotels and things.
Okay.
Or restaurants. What is the most recent?
Well, like, recently I bought a new hair dryer, and I was like, and of course before I do this,
this
I
is
Googled,
very relatable.
Me too.
I Googled best hair dryer.
Of course.
And then out of those, I picked one with, like, a decent price. And then I go on Amazon, look at the reviews, and cut to, I did not finish the work I had to do the whole thing because I procrastinated just overanalyzing fucking hair dryer. Just get a fucking hair dryer.
Who How is the hair dryer, though?
It's amazing,
awesome.
Actually. Yeah. Awesome. It is really good. It got 4.5 stars. So.
Well, you're talking to two guys that really can't relate about hair.
But get this. Dryers. I ordered it, and I got it in 3 hours.
What?
I know. What? Amazon Prime, baby. It's like... amazing.
I've actually heard, somebody just told me this, where certain local cities are getting it same day, but 3 hours is ridiculous.
I was surprised.
I'm in lowly Orange County, so I don't get that
the same
stuff.
Day, but usually if, like, I'll order it in the morning, I'll get it by like 8 p.m.
Really?
Or something. But it was like, I was out and I got home and I'm like, oh, I guess it's here.
Huh.
Anyway.
This is why podcasts have a bad rap.
I know, right? Oh my gosh.
We've digressed all the way to
here's
Amazon.
The thing,
yes.
Guy. I don't care what the masses think about anything.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, you
that's
should.
That's so healthy, isn't it?
That's so great.
I think I would be obsessed with that stuff.
And I'm also, once, especially on books and comics and TV and stuff, well, TV less so, but once it's out in the world, it's so far, it's been so long since you touched it that you have a pretty good distance from it.
Yeah.
Like, the books came out probably a year after we wrote them, and the comics tend to come out 6 months, 3 months even, but still, it's like... I'm always on the next thing. I'm always excited about the next thing.
Yeah.
So I hope people like them, but if they don't, I can't get involved with that.
So is that the only thing your heart is currently into, is the current thing? Like, you don't hold on to any of the stuff? You're not like, no. Oh, this was so great.
No, I think it's, you know, continued failure in the entertainment industry has taught me that you can't. You have to get excited about the next thing.
And just not, and put anything you've done before that behind you, essentially.
Yeah, because what are you supposed to do? You can't dwell on it. You can't say what did...
Well, I can dwell.
I have a question.
Don't challenge me.
I have a personal question. So not personal, but like, this is something I struggle with. Mm-hmm. So like, let's say you wrote a pilot and you have a deck and everything and you go out with it and you hear some no's. Mm-hmm. Do you stow it away, work on the next thing? Or do you keep trying and keep pushing and keep asking because you believe in it, because you think there's nothing that's ever been done like this and you really believe this is great and it just needs to find the right home or something?
Well, ideally in that round you'll be taking it to someone who would be the right home. Like, I think that's the good thing about the current marketplace, is there are only so many places who can do so many things, you know. Like, we're taking out a pitch right now, in fact, which is an hour long. Like, it's a big show. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Game of Thronesy, and so it goes to like 5 places, and then when that's done, it's done. Should the opportunity arise in, you know, 2 years, because we're wildly successful and people are like, what do you have in the bank,
right?
Then we'll take it out again. But no, I mean, you give it the shot. You give it everything. You only do things you're passionate about. We learn that too, because people can tell when you don't care.
Yeah. It's just because sometimes it's been forever since, like, you touched it, because you mm-hmm. finished it, that I don't think I don't care, but I lose the enthusiasm.
Yeah. That's why we try to get all our pitch meetings grouped together within like a month, honestly. And it's hard to do, and we don't always get that done. But yeah, the enthusiasm wanes because you keep facing no.
Right. And it's like, ugh, you know?
Yeah. How do I go in and pitch this to another place? But the fact is, that place is the place that could want it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when all five places say no, then you're like, okay, what's next?
Right.
You know, we have no dearth of ideas. Our problem is we have too many ideas.
Yeah.
So it's about finding the what's the next cool thing we want to try to put out there.
Right, right, right.
So are you okay with no? Does no, is no easy for you?
Well, it's easy because you don't have to do any more work. So right. That's good.
Yeah.
But it's not as good because you don't get paid and don't get to make a show.
It's no yes.
Right? That's actually funny because it's like I've been to a lot of situations where it's like, interesting. Tell us more. Yeah. It's like, okay, so you do more work and you do more work. And then like, no.
Yeah. And it happens all the time.
You know, and it's like you beat the levels on Mario. Mm-hmm. And it's like the last level,
there are always more levels. No, there are always more levels. Like, I know. We've sold, I think, 10 pilots. None have been made. Well, the animated one, we at least got to make a short, but that's none have been made.
Something. That's
we still money. Sold them, right?
Like, it becomes tiring when you're not getting paid.
Yes.
That's what I'm getting at.
But it becomes tiring because there are so many steps you have
to
do,
right? Of course.
After you pitch, and even if you sell it, it's then endless. You have to write it, and then you have to go through that notes process, and then they decide to make it, and then they decide if they're going to make the
it
show.
It literally is art. Like, you could make a painting and keep working on it for decades. The same goes, I think, for like TV shows and music and all that. Like, you could keep tinkering with it. Like, someone has to decide you are done.
Which is why you have to believe in it.
Yeah.
Because it would be so easy to, you know, get sick of that process.
Right.
And the other thing, again, I think we've only learned this in the past couple of years, is you can only... Everything is so much out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I hear this all the time on the writer's panel. Like, you can only... do well the thing that you have control of, which sure. is the pitch or the script.
Right.
And on those, you need to do the best you can. You can't guess at the pitch. A pitch especially, like you can tailor it if you want, but you can't compromise what you know that show is to be.
Sure.
Because again, that's the only thing you can control. After that, like they hear it, they have to sell it to their boss. They can misunderstand it. They can do a terrible job selling it. It's not what they're looking yeah. for this year. You know, they had something already with a monster in it. Like, there's so much you can't account for. Honestly. Which is why, like, you just can take out the thing you believe in.
It's funny, because I think I actually went into writing because I used to be an actress when I was younger. And I was sick of, like, I'm just going in for a 2-minute audition. And,
that seems even worse.
And it's like, I have to give this person my all or whatever and stand out and be better than all these 50 other lookalikes like me who are probably doing the same job, maybe better, maybe worse, but like probably the yeah. same. And like, what if the casting director's having a bad day or like a bad moment or I'm having a bad moment yeah. or, you know, so it's like, it didn't feel in my control.
Yeah.
It felt like I could work at my craft for ages and still not get it.
No.
So I felt that writing gave me more control. And I could, like, tinker with it and really, like, because, and it's something that, like, if you're an actor, you need, like, a director and, like, audience. You can't just, I can work in my closet and work on a script. Like, I mm-hmm. can do this wherever.
All you need is a pencil and a pad.
Yeah. It's, you know, so I felt more in control in that way. Mm-hmm. But in the sense, it's still not in your control.
No, but like, but you can at least, I feel like for an actor, and I have a lot of actor friends who go through this, and I don't know how they do it,
because
then they don't even get to choose the project.
Yeah.
Like, they're just trying to get work, and that is miserable. And auditioning is a whole different thing to actually acting.
Yeah.
At least as a writer, you can say, I want to concentrate on this project. Right. This is what I'm taking out. And that's what we've, you know, we're developing a show right now for a network that we can't talk about.
That's great,
but it's a
though.
Thing we believe in. And we sold a movie this year that
That's
we can't
amazing.
Talk about. But it's a thing we believe in. And these are things...
That's the thing about failures. You have all these successes.
But these are things we've put off for years because it didn't seem like the right things for... And this comic I'm doing is a thing I've thought about for 5 years. Mm-hmm. But I never... I didn't know if I could do something without Acker. But he was really nice and was like, you seem to get this. Go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And two... I didn't know if anyone would give a shit about it.
Yeah.
Just because I did doesn't mean other people do. But luckily, someone did. Vertigo did. So they're behind it.
And when you work, because you work on like so many different things at once, do you do it all at once? Or do you like one project?
Well, there are two of us. That really makes it easier.
Okay.
Honestly. Like,
do you always meet?
Ben and I will meet up. We'll sort of talk out a thing. If we can get to a whiteboard, we'll beat it out like that. If not, we'll sit at a coffee shop or something mm-hmm. and type it out on a computer so that we have sort of an outline that's made of notes. And then one of us will clean up that outline and we'll rework it as needed. And then one of us will go off on script, do a draft as fast as possible, turn it over to the other one, who will then do a second draft.
Really?
And we'll go back and forth till we're pretty happy with it. Oh. But usually it's just a couple drafts at this point.
Are there fights? I mean, there has to be some sort of like, eh, I didn't like that. No, no. I love it. Never?
No.
How That's why they're writing partners.
They it's get. 15 years.
I know, but I mean, you seem so evolved, Ben. I mean, like everything's like,
no, we never did.
Back. Not a problem.
I think generally we have the same sensibility or similar sensibility. And I think certainly we did at the start. And even if we don't necessarily like all the same things now, we agree that each other has tastes and we trust each other's taste.
Yeah.
That's so huge.
It absolutely yeah. is. And then so the rule has sort of always been like whoever cares more wins. And it's always apparent. Like we never have to fight about that. Hmm. He's a very logical writer. He will poke it with, you know, to make the logic work. And I'm a very instinctive writer. And I sort of, you know, work from a big idea to the small idea, but he will work from a small idea out. And somehow that works. Like he trusts my gut and I trust his brain.
That's amazing.
I really do think having the same taste as your writing partner is like crucial.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're different enough. I tend yeah. to be more commercial. He tends to be
well, you
more
gotta be different. Personality that's driven. That's what makes it special.
Yeah, that, and that's I think that's where that friction is where the good stuff comes from.
Yeah, like I'm working on a movie with my friend and, you know, but our writing process is kind of different. Like we will outline together, mm-hmm. but we'll write each scene differently. So we'll split up scenes. Mm-hmm. So like she'll go off and write this scene. I'll go write that scene. We'll combine them and mm-hmm. then read them and then like tinker as needed.
Yeah, which is not unusual. I mean, yeah. I've talked to a lot of partnerships on the Writers Panel podcast and like everybody does it differently.
Yeah.
You know, for us, the way we work is mostly about efficiency.
Right.
You know, because we're never working on just one thing.
Sure.
So like, what's the best way to get this done? Well, if he can be on script on one thing, I can be on script on another thing. Yeah. So we'll break stuff simultaneously.
And how'd you find time to write your book?
What book?
They're coming out with.
Oh, this hot comic called yeah. Hexwives. It's really squeezing it in.
Yeah.
Like, luckily, I had a little time this summer because we were waiting for deals to close.
Okay.
So the timing was perfect.
Wow, so you just finished it.
I'm just turned in issue 5.
Oh, amazing.
It is an ongoing series coming from DC Vertigo on Halloween.
Oh, great.
Wow.
But here's the thing I've learned about comics, you guys. And we've done a bunch, but I've never been quite so involved as this.
Well, this is all yours.
This is all mine, so yeah. I care about it. I can't offload the caring.
Right.
Pre-orders are very important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Turns out. That is the signal to the publisher for how much someone is interested in your book.
Okay.
So this is a book called Hexwives. It is about witches. It is about basically if Samantha from Bewitched didn't know she was a powerful witch and was not a suburban housewife by choice. And so one day the first arc is about her finding out that she and her neighbors are this powerful coven
nice.
Being held captive by these horrible men.
Huh.
It is also about the insidious ways men control women.
And where can we pre-order this?
I'm glad you asked. Call up your local comic book shop. If you don't know where your local comic book shop is, go to comicshoplocator.com,
wow.
put in your zip code, and it'll tell you. Call them up, tell them you want Hexwives, #1. It comes out on Halloween. They will hold you a copy. Then you go in and you drop $4 and you get it.
$4. It's a bargain.
It's nothing.
Nothing. No.
That is parking for 15 minutes in West Hollywood, everybody.
And if you have to pick it up in West Hollywood, just say, I'm just running in to get a comic book and come back out. Save the $4 and you paid for
pick
the comic
book. Pick up a second book, maybe.
You know what? You it's go. Cheaper for me to get that book than it is to get like an Uber.
That's true.
To like Echo Park around or some
the,
shit.
To around the corner.
Just Little saying.
Yeah. To go to Little Dom's. It's cheaper for you to get this book.
Right. So everybody should do that. Plus, I actually have this fascination. I think I told you this when I saw you last time, like in person. I have this fascination with witches. I think they stand for women and feminism that is against like rebellion and stuff that's not traditional. If you go back to Salem witch trials, I was always fascinated with them.
Absolutely.
When I was a kid, I was like, I'm a witch.
Like, I know. Like, you guys think I'm, like, a crazy person, but I know. And I had this book of spells that I got from the Hallmark shop.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was probably all bogus, but I, like, no, did I'm spells. Sure it wasn't. And, like, when I was, like, 8 years old. And I loved all these TV shows with witches. I loved Bewitched. Mm-hmm. And I loved Sabrina and all those stuff. Yeah. I don't know. I just always really had a big fascination with them.
I had a fascinating conversation at Comic-Con last month. I did a pop culture witches panel because I'm promoting this book.
Right.
And so I had Nell Scovell, who created Sabrina, who's amazing.
She's going to be a guest here.
Oh, good. Yeah. I hope so. She's the best. Great. I had the creators of the upcoming Charmed reboot were on it. I had Ruth Connell, who has played a witch in 24 episodes of Supernatural. I had Tomi Adeyemi, who wrote this amazing young adult book called Children of Blood and Stone, I believe it's called.
Ooh.
And it's sort of about Africa. It's like African Harry Potter.
Ooh,
it's
cool.
Awesome. And then I had a practicing witch on the panel who is the wife of a friend of mine, who is a friend of mine. And we had this really interesting conversation about, like, what do witches represent and why are they evil?
Why are we hunting
why
them?
Are they monsters? And it's because they're all about female power. It was the stuff you as a kid were looking at going, I want to be a witch.
Yeah.
Right? Like that. Those powers are awesome.
That's the thing. And I was like thinking about this with my therapist, honestly. And I was like, as a kid, I went through a lot of trauma. My mom had breast cancer, died when I was very young. Mm-hmm. A lot of things were not in my control. Back to the control thing. And feeling that I had some power in this world, like,
yeah,
I could fix this, or I could get this boy I have a crush on to like me or something, that made me feel a little bit better. And that's what the thought of witchcraft did for me.
Yeah,
so,
100%.
Yeah, that's what.
It's funny really now that you say this.
But it's demonized, which is the interesting thing. Like, they are monsters.
Well, it's like Lindy West said, like, you know, witch hunts, it's like, yeah, like, you're hunting me, I'm going to hunt you. Like,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Well, hasn't Trump ruined that whole the witch hunt thing?
What did Trump not ruin?
Good point.
But I'm like, yeah, no, the whole
Trump ruined everything.
It's more insulting that he's calling himself a witch if they're female empowerment, like, you know,
which that's all based on the Salem witch trials.
Yes.
The thing is, those weren't witches,
right?
Yeah, those were not witches.
This guy's actually guilty,
right? Exactly, exactly. We
like I don't care. I mean, the way that, I mean, I'm sure you guys know because you know your history, but like the way they would try these witches frequently was throw them in the water, and if they drown, then they are not a witch,
right?
And if they float, then they are a witch. So let's kill them.
Either way.
Honestly, if we try Trump that way, I'm fine.
Good.
You're about to get suspended from Twitter just for saying that.
Oh,
I don't even like it. But I've been hearing this a lot, like in the industry talk of like people about like the Me Too movement, like, oh, it's a witch hunt, all these women. No. And I'm like, if you did not do anything, you are not scared.
Exactly.
Like, you are fine.
I agree.
Don't worry. We know the difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes. People are not stupid.
Yes. Yes. You're not being hunted. If you're scared of being hunted, then you did something wrong.
Yeah.
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 So anyway,
before we go to our final two questions, just for me,
I have time for four more.
Okay, I have three. So one,
I'm going to make one up.
So for me, the question was: so, like, if you have your druthers, like, what's the? Is everything right where it's supposed to be? Is your professional life at a 10 right now, or is there something else that could push it further than it is currently?
No, I don't think there's ever any comfort in this industry. I mean, look, we have these two projects that we're doing, and I have the comic book, which is creatively fulfilling and people seem to like, but everything could go away, right?
And it's all gig to gig.
It really,
like,
is.
Which is this industry. Like, you could do fine,
so yeah,
and then, like, the
breathe.
Next thing.
You can never breathe.
No, and frankly, I don't want to. Like,
boring,
I like all the stuff I'm working on. I hate pitching. I would love to not pitch. Like, I'd love to sell one more thing so I can work on those for these three things for a year, mm-hmm. and not have to pitch something for a year, but... You know, also, I'm sure in 6 months, if I did sell another thing, I'd be like, oh, I have this idea. I would love to take this out.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I like to be constantly entertained by it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I like the work. That's the other thing, is like, I think you have to like the work.
Yeah. Or love it. No.
Yeah. People complain about writing all the time, and I do too. And, you know, Acker may be the only person I know who doesn't. He loves the actual process.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing else I'd rather do.
Yeah,
I mean, I like making stuff. The best part for me is when he and I are sitting in a room coming up with a show or a pitch or whatever it is, and I can't get that kick anywhere else.
Okay, here's my extra question. Best advice you can give to a young writer?
Just keep doing it. Honestly, I think I'm coming up on 400 episodes of the Writers Panel podcast.
Wow.
And yes, it's been a while. And so I've interviewed over 1,000 writers for this thing.
Yeah.
And the thing, the best advice that anyone can give, the best advice that I've gotten from this is just to keep doing it. The only way to learn how to do it is to do it, but don't let it sit in a drawer either. Mm-hmm. You have to get your stuff out into the world, whether that means shooting a YouTube video, whether it means putting on a stage show, whether it means a sketch show, whatever it is, put it up online. Like, the stuff has to live out in the world so people can see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, but I honestly think that's why a lot of female writers are not, there's not a lot of female writers, I think, because I think a lot of them are scared to share and show the world. And
it's true, writers of color too. Like, yeah. There's a barrier to entry for this stuff.
Mm-hmm. But it's so important to show it.
Like, there's no barrier to entry to just posting your script online.
Yeah.
Honestly. Or posting your pitch, a 30-second pitch. You can do that on your phone.
Yeah.
You know, get people excited about that.
I posted like short, dumb sketches on my Twitter, and it got me meetings, you know.
That's great. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, Twitter's become this a really good equalizer.
Right.
In a lot of ways. But you can't call yourself a writer unless you're a writer.
You got to keep doing it. Yeah.
Okay, that's fair.
The way to success in this business is tenacity.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Just keep on doing it.
Okay, you have to want it more than anything else. Hmm. I mean, I'm lucky I've been married for 11 years, so I don't have to worry about my outside life.
Yeah, same thing.
That helps.
All this other stuff.
And to bring it back full circle, Decently Funny, my first podcast, we did do a writer's panel, writer's roundtable, a couple times, but the first episode was Sam Simon, Peter Melman, Danny Zucker.
That's great.
Pretty
we
good
had one for our show, too.
Yes, we did it with Scully, Zucker, and Alex Sulkin.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, they're great.
So, but you kind of do it more like, you have them segmented kind of into like types of genres.
Those are a pain in the ass to book.
I
grab three writers. And it's actually more interesting when they don't have experiences in common, mm-hmm. where like I'll get a drama writer, a comedy writer, whatever, a genre writer.
Yeah.
And that they've... through the conversation, they find stuff in common is really fun.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm just there to facilitate that conversation.
Have you ever, I'm just curious for my own, I'm interested. Have you
I
ever,
have time for four more.
Have you ever done ghostwriters? People that write for other people?
No, I don't really care.
Really?
Yeah, not so interested.
I think it's fascinating.
Listen, I get to make the podcast, so I get to chase what I'm interested in.
I know, yeah, I know, exactly. I know. But
people ask me, like,
I recently just discovered this whole underworld of ghostwriting.
This
and
is
I was
the thing.
Like, whoa.
We know some.
Yeah.
No, like people will, and I want people to suggest who they want on the podcast, but people will often suggest like animation people, and I don't watch cartoons.
Right.
So I don't really have a lot of them.
Got it.
Interesting. Cool. It's kind of like the Warren Buffett approach. You know, he doesn't invest in anything he doesn't understand or like, yeah.
Right.
Same kind of thing. Okay.
Also, I just book people I can get.
Yeah, that helps too. Penultimate question.
Wait, when does this come out?
This comes out on Thursday.
Will you guys come to my 400th episode? I'm doing a live show on Sunday, the 26th of August.
I can be there.
6 p.m. Yes. I have amazing writers for it. It's at the Dynasty Typewriter.
Yeah.
Go to dynastytypewritertheater.com or something like that.
Amazing.
Okay.
But yeah, it's an awesome lineup. On my 300th, I did a show at Largo, and I tried so hard to book a diverse panel. This was like 2 years ago now. And I wound up with like 16 white guys and two women and one person of color. And they were an amazing, like it was Mike Shore and Carlton Cuse and Damon. Like it was a great panel, but
you know what happened?
It represented
like,
Hollywood at the time.
I think it was Variety or something. It was like, oh, writer's panel, like comedy. And there was no women in it.
In drama and
comedy. Right. It was not one, which
and
is crazy.
My pal Liz Hanna went on Twitter and was like,
right. And I could name like 15 for each genre, just like off the top of my head.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and yes. And like 2 years ago, there weren't as many female showrunners. There weren't as many showrunners of color.
Yeah.
Especially on sort of big shows. So now, luckily, this panel is all women.
Amazing.
It's, I think, half people of color. If not, it's
great.
Near that.
That's all great.
But they're all working on stuff that I'm really interested in.
That's perfect.
And it should be a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Yes.
So yeah, we'll go.
Okay.
Please do. Let me know if you want to come.
I want to go. Penultimate question. I use that word twice now in a row. Is what is your biggest failure?
How do you define a big failure?
I mean, it really, it depends. Each
it could
person
be anything professionally.
Yeah.
I'm just stalling.
Like when I do job interviews, I ask people what their greatest success was actually.
Oh, ask me that instead.
Well,
this is not the premise.
But this is
the promise of premise.
I honestly, I feel like this business is a series of small failures. I don't feel like there's been one thing where I've said, like, that's it, I can't go on.
Yeah.
Like, that's what a big failure would feel like to me.
Okay.
I feel like, as we've talked about, like, you hear no all the time. Well, mostly you hear, like, no comment.
Right.
Or
the Hollywood
or
no.
You just don't hear anything.
You hear nothing.
You get ghosted by Hollywood.
Which is the worst kind of no.
Yeah. Right.
But you hear it frequently. Or don't hear it frequently.
Right.
And it's not that I've become used to it. It's just that, like, now I understand that that's how it works.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to take as many at-bats as you can.
Mm-hmm. That's the business, essentially.
Yeah, it's just part of the business.
And you're okay with it.
Yeah, I think you have to be. I've found the fun in the other parts. Like, I would love for someone to say yes, and, like, I'd love for them to pick up the show that we're writing.
Right.
But I'm also happy to take out the next thing. So, yeah, I mean, no one big failure, but... yeah, decades.
Lots
of
little ones
small
along the way
ones.
That got you to where you are today.
I think so.
A success.
I think you have to see these things. I mean, I feel like I hear this on your podcast all the time, is you have to see these things as learning experiences.
For absolutely.
Personal failures also.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure I know I've been shitty many times, but I have to learn from them.
That's true. As long as you're learning and getting better. So the reason I do hold my phone sometimes is because I have to write down for the final question, what is your favorite charity?
I'm glad you asked. My wife works in nonprofit. She does consulting for nonprofits.
Oh, nice.
So I asked her for a couple of good ones who, you know, could use a couple $100 where, like, it would actually make a difference. And I think the conversation many of us have had the past couple of years is the best way to give is locally. The best way to make a difference is locally. The Red Cross doesn't need your money.
No, I know.
They're doing fine.
They're fine. They also were something with Jews. I read.
Cross.
Red.
No, but they like did not help Jews during like a crisis of the Holocaust or something. They turned a blind eye. I don't know. Something I read on Snopes.
So these are two organizations that my wife and I were talking about. She doesn't work with either of them, but she really likes them. And I do too. Because she said, what's the stuff you like?
Right,
here's
right.
The stuff I like. So CHIRLA, CHIRLA, is the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights.
Oh, that's beautiful.
They are local. They do civic education. They provide immigration legal services for immigration and policy work to protect the human and civil rights of immigrants.
Perfect.
I think that's a great way to sort of make a difference.
Perfect. We're going to give $100 to Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights.
That's great.
From Ben Blacker. Thank you so much for being on our show. We're really glad you're here. And of course, the link to the charity is always in the show notes. So look for that. Please donate yourself. Feel free to do so. Eden, thank you.
Thank me.
Ben, you're on Twitter.
I sure
am. You're at Ben Blacker on Twitter.
Yeah, it's just my name, guys.
Yeah, follow
him. Get his
it's
new
like
comic book.
The color, only more so. Yeah, and pre-order. Follow me there and pre-order Hexwives, and my Twitter will tell you how to do it. Thank you for having me. I really love the show. So
we appreciate
so
you coming on.
Yay. All right,
thanks,
bye,
everybody.
Guys.